You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Echoes in the Dark. After the shocking murder of four Idaho college kids last fall, a media frenzy exploded into their quiet town, boosting the image of upstart news reporters, but bringing along a new breed of web sleuth, conspiracy-minded, vindictive, and often dead wrong, by Kathleen Hale. Opening photo, an aerial view of the Moscow, Idaho house where Ethan Chapin, Zaniker Nodal, Kaylee Gonsalves, and Maddie Mogan were murdered. Corner Club owner Mark Trivelpiece was starting to hate reporters. As a rule, he condemns violence. Anyone who throws punches in the Corner Club gets booted. But 3 weeks into the media storm surrounding the murders of four college kids in his town, Trivelpiece was beginning to think that people don't get punched in the face enough. On November 13th, Ethan Chapin, Zaniker Nodal, Kaylee Gonsalves, and Maddie Mogan had been stabbed to death in the girls' off-campus house in Moscow, home to the University of Idaho. Trivelpiece's bar is where two of the victims, Gonsalves and Mogan, spent their last evening on Earth. When the murders made news, the media swarmed, and Trivelpiece's business in particular came under siege. "I want the Corner Club to be famous," he said, "but not for this." When reporters barged in, talking about the murders in such a casual way, Trivelpiece was like, "Whatever you guys want to talk about at home is fine, but their friends, the victims, are sitting right here, so let's not do this." He turned down location fees from NBC, ignored calls from TMZ, banished journalists from as far away as the London Telegraph. But they kept coming. Someone claiming to be from Fox News had recently followed a Corner Club employee's roommate to work. Like other Moscow business owners, Trivelpiece's workforce and customer base are heavily composed of students who make up about half the town's population. After the murders, an estimated 25 to 40% of those students fled home. There was a killer on the loose. But Trivelpiece wondered if media harassment played a role in the mass exodus. How many students aren't going to come back because Fox News is sitting out in front of their house? Trivelpiece knew I was media as soon as I walked into his bar. The tell was not just that he didn't recognize me. Trivelpiece isn't great with names, he says, but he knows most patrons by their drink orders. Bush Light, pint, whiskey and coke, keeps his straws. But more so that newcomers usually take a moment to admire the impressive collection of sports memorabilia, whereas my eyes went straight to the security cameras. Before agreeing to speak to me, he asked for my driver's license and set about making sure that I was not with Fox News. "We're in mourning, and we're a small town, and we know what's going to happen," he said to me. "You guys are going to go home, and you're going to write your story. And if you write something that maybe puts us in a negative light, it doesn't matter to you, but it matters to us. And we have to sit around and deal with the repercussions of that and explain to the rest of the community, 'I was misquoted,' or, you know, 'They didn't understand what I was saying.' And we don't want to do that. We just want to be there for each other right now." The bar's only rule was don't be an asshole. In a single day, Trivelpiece had thrown out 11 reporters. The problem was he could not throw out the invisible army of internet trolls who followed those reporters, and exponentially more of them flocked to his social media pages and the pages of his employees every time Corner Club was mentioned in the news. He'd read Reddit threads that painted Moscow as a dark, depressing town because the sun set at 4:30 p.m. "Well, we didn't effing choose when or where our time zone borders are," Trivial Peace said. Someone, Mike Gumbali, had left a Google review of the bar saying, "These girls Kaylee and Maddie told me the food is to die for." Trivial Peace's staff member Adam was doxxed and harassed after news networks aired security camera footage of Gonsalves and Mogan walking around downtown Moscow talking about someone named Adam. "They want to click on their TikTok or their YouTube or whatever," said Trivial Peace, referring to reporters and internet trolls that follow in their wake. "All social media's done is make idiots realize they're not alone." Other local businesses faced similar scrutiny. "My shit is bad right now with these assholes," texted Trivial Peace's buddy Jeff Smitty Smith, who owns Moscow Bagel and Deli down the road. At the time, Smith was paying twice the price for 20% less profit at night. He decided to keep his store double-staffed after dark, hoping to make his young employees feel safer and insulate them from the ongoing media harassment. Instead, the store was getting bombarded and borderline terrorized, in Smith's words, by acolytes of YouTube psychic Reverend Donna Serafina, who told her then 46,400 subscribers that the Moscow murderer, whoever that was, at the time there were no suspects or arrest, baked his own bread at a bread place, possibly owned by said murderer's parents. Since posting the video, Serafina has gained more than 10,000 subscribers. "I don't make my own bread," Smith corrected them. "I don't have a son. I've never married, never had a child." But it was no use. The messages and comments and posts proliferated. Visits to the company Facebook page soared from 243 to 231,038. For failing to turn in his non-existent son, Smith received a suspicious catering order from Douchey Coward Incorporated. Trivial Peace, a University of Idaho alum, was hanging out with his bulldogs, Matilda and Sarge, when one of his buddies reached out to say the Corner Club was on TV again, this time on News Nation's Banfield, hosted by Ashley Banfield, whom readers might remember from her MSNBC coverage of the 9/11 attacks, who is now a more sotto voce Nancy Grace. It was December 12th. A news banner read, "Day 29, killer is still on the loose." Banfield's somber face was left in a triptych of live shots opposite a slideshow of the Corner Club, this side of the building, that side of the building, the neon business sign. Stage center, 37-year-old News Nation reporter Brian Enton, a tan, attractive man with thick gray hair. "The Corner Club," Banfield intoned. "That's where Kaylee and Maddie were." "Yeah," Enton looked somber. "I've been there. There are a lot of cameras there." "There were cameras on the outside and cameras on the inside, as far as I can tell. I went inside. The bartender wouldn't talk, but I saw the cameras with my own eyes." "Idiot," Trivial Peace thought. When Enton descends on a town, he brings with him more than 444,200 Twitter followers and counting, nearly eight times the size of Serafina's fan base. Many of them started following Enton over the course of his 2021 reporting on Gabby Petito. Prior to that, Enton had about 20,000 followers. Enton's reporting on Petito also earned him the nickname News Daddy. In a Reddit sub devoted to him, Enton's fans rave, "News Daddy is the only daddy you need, and dude grinds for sure." On November 28th, 15 days after the murders, Enten arrived in Moscow and drove straight to the crime scene in a huge black rented SUV he called the Big Premium Daddy. In weeks prior, he'd been chasing candidates and stuff, like Herschel Walker and Raphael Warnock. Enten didn't mind covering politics, but acknowledged that they were not my passion. Part of what he likes about the crime stuff, Enten told me, is that it tends to be apolitical, especially when the crime is unsolved. This, he said, referencing the murders, is a little bit of a break from that. At 12:24 a.m., Enten opened Twitter live. Multicolored hearts exploded from the lower right corner of the screen. Comments unfurled. Hi from Maryland. You are the best reporter ever, Australia. Hey, everybody, Enten said. He kept his iPhone camera angled at the crime scene. Police line, do not cross, tape, wrapped around the property, draped across stones and poles and trees and garbage cans, over fuse boxes and door jams. I just wanted to get on here real quick, just let you guys know that we made it to Moscow, he told his followers. This is the house where the murders happened. Had to be an inside job. Please find out where Jack S. lives and let's give it a visit. Enten's followers meant Jack Showalter, a University of Idaho student who'd walked Mogan and Gonsalves from the corner club to a food truck hours before their deaths. Now web sleuths were convinced that Showalter was the killer. Moscow police had not dignified the conspiracy by naming Showalter, referencing him on the King Road homicide updates page as mail and grub truck surveillance video under the heading. At this time in the investigation, detectives do not believe the following are involved in this crime. In just a few days, News Nation would send a producer to Showalter's house, where a neighbor allegedly intercepted that producer and sent him away. So extreme was the harassment, both on and offline, that the whole neighborhood seemed to be rallying around the family. Before signing off, Enten reminded his followers, there's a murderer on the loose. Over the next 2 weeks, Enten maintained a solemn tone, staring at the camera while snow accumulated on his shoulders, and forced himself to look comfortable, even though, just like during his hurricane and tropical storm coverage, he'd reported on Ian, Sally, Michael, Irma, Matthew, Hermine, Dorian, Etta, Laura, Ida, and Erica. He almost felt like he was going to die. Half of it is just like stamina, Enten said. It's not about being smart. Despite his long johns, which Enten was still getting used to, it's just such a weird thing, he said, shuffling his feet. Like my legs are so cozy and I feel like a penguin. He was freezing. So was his cameraman, Mo Moran. His producer, Lauren Powell, sucked on a fireball to stay warm. Between segments on Banfield, they retreated for warmth to the daddy wagon, where they listened to their team anthem, Kiss from a Rose. The SUV was a tangle of paper towels, hand warmers, liquid Robitussin, and Powell's bags of hard candy. Enten refused her offer of a lollipop, remembering the time he'd reported live outside Mar-a-Lago with a green tongue. On December 4th, I flew to Moscow to watch Enten's first ever special. I'm going to be much better to talk to after today, he promised me. I'm kind of crazy right now, like I'm nervous. When I asked if he usually feels nervous before live shows, he shook his head. Normally, I do feel normal. In his hotel room, Enten prepared for the special while Fox News played on TV. He always kept something on, toggling between stations to make sure nobody else was getting the scoop. For now, Enten was safe. The Fox pundits were shouting about how reparations for slavery are racist. This is where I am about to start getting crazy. So don't judge me for, like, the next 4 hours, Enten reminded me. He proceeded to rehearse his lines, cycling through salt and vinegar chips while typing and muttering shit or F. Live in Moscow, Moscow, Moscow. Enten drilled, Moscow. Outsiders pronounced it Moscow, but locals said Moscow. I've learned that the hard way, Enten said. I asked what it would take for him to leave Moscow and go someplace else. Enten thought about it. I mean, I hate to say it, a really bad school shooting or a plane crash, like something catastrophic, Moran offered. Yeah, Powell said. Catastrophic, Enten agreed. Later, outside the crime scene, Enten swiped foundation under his eyes like war paint and braced himself for the show to start. Does my hood look right? He asked. Sometimes I think it looks weird. After some consideration, he decided against wearing earmuffs. All right, guys, Enten said. Let's do this. It's going to be good. Moments later, he was on the air, recapping the crime for anyone just tuning in. A nightmare for this town. A nightmare they just cannot wake up from. Enten's Idaho murder mystery special report contained exclusive interviews and one shocking detail. Gonsalves' injuries were significantly more brutal than Mogan's. In the absence of any new updates from police, sleuths took off running with what Enten had to offer. Internet sleuths are on the case, Enten said in his special. We are talking about the armchair detectives, people who sift through social media for any possible clue. And in the vacuum of information from Moscow police, their voices are louder than ever. Web sleuths earned their moniker in 1999 on a site by the same name, but their movement arguably reached a pinnacle during the 2010 to 2012 crime at the center of Don't F with Cats, a docuseries about the online manhunt for Luca Magnotta, who posted videos of himself killing cats before graduating to homicide. In that case, sleuths succeeded where police had failed, bolstering their reputation as capable detectives. According to media scholars, historical examples such as Magnotta helped to fuel the fantasy, further energized by the rise of participatory media culture that audience members are viewers with a job to do. Since then, crime reporters have been in competition with a new breed of paparazzo. While reporting on Petito from her killer's lawn, Enten found himself shoulder to shoulder with vigilante civilians and social media influencers like Bullhorn Betty, who would later upload three videos about one of the Moscow victims' surviving roommates, featuring a thumbnail image of Zana Kernodle's face with the words, "Why didn't you save me?" Like many sleuths, Betty's methods seem unscrupulous. She reports rumors and perpetuates harassment of innocent people. But for practical reasons, Enten has needed to find a way to coexist with people like her. I just want to get my job done every day, he told me, refusing to speak ill of Betty, in part, he jokes, because I don't want her showing up to my house with a bullhorn. More seriously, Enten said that it's not up to him whether sleuths have earned their place among trained reporters. The reality is that our digital ecosystem elevates the voices of specialist and enthusiast alike. At the end of the day, they're still going to be here, he said. I'm still going to be here. Nothing else. Something else began to happen during the Petito case, too. I just started to hear like ka-ching, ka-ching. Strangers were sending Enten random amounts of money on Venmo, a standard source of income for sleuths like Bullhorn Betty, which would have been fine if Enten were self-employed, but he had a salary job at News Nation. $20 rolled in before he could figure out how to set his Venmo to private. Despite his professional use of Twitter, Enten is the first to admit he's not exactly internet savvy. He doesn't have a TikTok account, and seemed surprised to hear that there are TikToks about him. He had never visited Reddit. Have you ever been on Reddit? It's like really popular, right? Another time he commented to me, next door, have you ever heard of that app? Once he referenced web sleuths as the internet people. When asked whether he thought sleuths might be causing more harm than good, Enten answered, "I really think that 99, he caught himself, well, maybe not 99, but like 90% of the web sleuths have good intentions. It's a common misconception that sleuths solved Petito's murder. In reality, sleuthing helped police focus the search for Petito's body, but it's a stretch to say amateur sleuths found her." As Isaac West, an associate professor at Vanderbilt University and author of The Serial Effect, True Crime and Contemporary American Culture, says, "People are participating in a social drama, but their participation and achieving justice are disconnected. One is not causing the other. Yet sleuths persist in the belief that they are heroes." As at Lacey J. Meeks, follower count 1,273, tweeted during the Moscow murders investigations, "For hand clap emoji, the hand clap emoji, love hand clap emoji, of hand clap emoji, God hand clap emoji," and then two scowling red faces, and in all caps, "I wish at Moscow PDPIO would provide us the finders of Gabby P. with info." Murder investigations happen on a microscopic level. After graduating from the police academy, a grueling process that involves physically demanding drills and literal obstacle courses, an aspiring homicide detective undergoes years of training. To denigrate this process may partly reflect society's growing discomfort with law enforcement. There have been many instances of police murdering civilians. Fearing them makes sense. But considering oneself more capable of solving a quadruple homicide from afar using only a computer speaks to a larger delusion that online we can do anything, get rich, become famous, lead revolutions, diagnose ourselves with rare diseases, and solve mysteries. Only a week after the murders, so many damaging rumors swirled on social media that Moscow police issued an update saying, "We urge reliance on official channels for accurate information." Instead, trolls and social media stalkers harassed young reporters at the Argonaut, U of I's student newspaper, the Idaho Capital Sun reported. As Enten made his way through Moscow, sleuths spread untrue rumors that Mogan had bullied her freshman roommate into suicide, and the stabbings were an act of revenge, carried out 2 days before what would have been the dead girl's birthday. Others claimed one of the girl's neighbors, Jeremy, was the culprit. Why else would he give interviews to the reporters camped outside? Hoping to set the record straight, Jeremy did more interviews and voluntarily provided his DNA to police. Yet the so-called sleuthing intensified to a point where he felt it necessary to carry a pistol for protection. TikToker Ashley Gillard, also known as Ashley Solves Mysteries, who claims to crack crimes using tarot cards, uploaded 6 TikTok videos accusing U of I professor Rebecca Schofield, who was in Oregon when the murders occurred, of not only having a sexual relationship with one of the victims, but of ordering a hitman to carry out the stabbings. As a result, Gillard's followers unleashed on Schofield with such intensity that she grew concerned for her children's safety. Eventually, Schofield filed a lawsuit, which is still unfolding, but Gillard has refused to back down, saying, "I am not stopping." Enten had mixed feelings about social media. On one hand, he relied on his followers for tips that broke news. He used Twitter to broadcast updates, which he referred to as nuggets. At the same time, he feared getting canceled, both figuratively, like all it takes is one mistake, everybody could turn on me, and existentially, as in straight up disappeared, like in the crime stories he covered. Sometimes, while covering unsolved homicides, like the Moscow murders, Enten pictured the killer watching him, getting angry, wanting revenge. What if they kidnapped him? It soothed him to know that if he did go missing, I would have a really good army of people trying to find me. Next photo, Gonsalves and Mogan spent their last evening alive at the Corner Club, a local bar, whose neon sign is pictured here. After the special, Enten's fans fixated on his stuffed-up voice, messaging to ask whether he was sick or if it was merely allergies. A private investigator texted to say that Enten's eyes looked like slits and he should try Robitussin. Sleuths posted screenshots of the segment, claiming Enten wasn't really in Moscow at all, that the snow was fake, and he had been standing in front of a green screen. On Reddit, people debated whether NewsDaddy was a real journalist or just another influencer. Under Enten's tweet about the special, someone whined, "Total waste of 42 minutes. Days earlier, Enten had witnessed a viral score in the making. At the time, news was sagging, and networks clamored to keep the story alive by roping in commentary from former FBI agents and what Inside Edition referred to as the best-known lawyers and detectives. Enten and his team were stationed on King Road when they heard loud music. So loud, Enten said, you could hear it big time from the murder house. Kernodle, Gonsalves, and Mogan's home was a five-minute walk from Ethan Chapin's fraternity. Standing at the end of the girls' driveway, you could see Sigma Chi in the distance. Now brash voices echoed across the field. The fraternity vibrated with noise. Songs played, people shouted, brothers gathered on the deck. That's interesting, they're kind of partying, Enten thought. That would be something that could get a lot of attention. It was an understatement. Rumors, which would later turn out to be false, were emerging that some of Chapin's fraternity brothers had committed the murders, motivated by an ongoing feud with Kernodle and Chapin that had reignited earlier that same evening at the Sigma Chi house. People were saying that Kernodle had sexually rejected the boys in question, while Chapin had allegedly called them on their steroid use and become enraged when they could not successfully tutor him. This dubious theory gained traction on 4chan, an unmoderated site where users relish in misogyny. "I'd like to stab her with my D," someone posted in reference to the Moscow murders, and racism. In that same thread, the N-word appears 23 times. Enten thought back to his own college years. He was goofy. He drank. Footage of the Sigma Chi party would spotlight his reporting, if only for a day, and gain him even more followers. But it would also change a bunch of college kids' futures. Sleuths could easily track down the photos, names, or addresses for everyone in the fraternity, canceling more kids on the cusp of professional life. Enten felt sorry for them. In the end, he decided not to take the shot. Who knew why they were partying? It might have been for Chapin. Everyone grieves differently. College students in particular have their own way of coping. 2 weeks after the stabbing, one of Gonsalves' good friends would post pictures of herself and a bunch of other girls smiling, showing off their new Kaylee-inspired tattoos. "We're not internet sleuths. We're not working for Twitter," Enten reminded his team. "We have to remember what sets us apart from the YouTubers, from the Twitter." Growing up in Fort Lauderdale, Enten loved America's Most Wanted, a show that invited viewers to call a tip line and participate in the crime-solving process. The program has credited itself with helping to catch 1,186 fugitives in its 23 years on air, platforming what media scholars describe as our society's increasingly popularized and rejuvenated expectation that entertainment changes things. When Enton wasn't watching crime shows, he spent his evenings glued to local news. If he recognized the surroundings of the 5 p.m. segment, he'd beg his mom to drive him to the location so he could watch the 6 p.m. shot in person. They were like real celebrities to me, these local reporters. He especially idolized Carmel Caferio of WSVN Miami, a legend whose factual yet dramatic reporting inspired his own news mantra, "Make it not boring." Other boys picked on him for not watching sports, quizzing him on last night's game in front of everyone. I don't even think I knew I was gay, but somehow they must have picked up on it. In fourth or fifth grade, he enrolled in a new school where the students put on a TV program each morning. When Enton's turn came, he invited his mom and dad to watch. He told them he'd made a lot of friends. But when he and his parents exited the school's media center, after he finished the announcements, everybody booed. It was bad enough that the administration made the kids write apology letters to Enton's mom. She kept them all. Next photo, News Nation senior national correspondent Brian Enton tapes a special report on the case in December. And here he stands outside in the street at night, snow in the foreground, the house in question in the background. Years later, Enton went to the University of Missouri, which has one of the best journalism schools in the country. As junior year approached, Enton's GPA wasn't high enough to qualify for the program, so he settled on English and worked as a local news truck driver, making $5.15 an hour. He secured his first anchoring job while in college. Having studied local news his entire life, Enton slipped seamlessly into the work of making it himself, though initially he struggled to be himself, trying instead to imitate Peter Jennings. Old school journalism, emotionless, he put it to me, like, oh my God, I'm going to sound so professional, you know. That changed after Anderson Cooper's 2005 coverage of Hurricane Katrina. There was this time where he would just go from disaster to disaster, Enton recalled. I just remember being really impressed and like wanting to be him, basically. He was showing what was going on and getting really upset about it. Known for taking risky assignments that seemed at odds with his privileged upbringing, Cooper had never covered a hurricane. But in Baton Rouge, he slid a condom over his microphone and dove right in, becoming famous for saying things like, "Excuse me, Senator, I'm sorry for interrupting. For the last 4 days, I've been seeing dead bodies in the streets. To hear politicians thanking each other and complimenting each other. Literally, there was a body on the streets of this town yesterday being eaten by rats." Cooper helped popularize a reporting persona that's become standard, the emotive man. The New York Observer called him the emo anchor. Unlike his predecessors, teleprompted voices of God, Cooper stuttered, rambled, even wept. A 2005 New York profile described his style as befuddled, spooked, rambling, unhinged, and flipped out. Attributes that have come to define the 24-hour news cycle. When Cooper was rising to fame, there were so few openly gay anchors Enton could look up to, including Cooper, who didn't come out until 2012. But in the meantime, he gave male reporters like Enton permission to be themselves, to use simple language, and fill the space between sound bites with other statements of fact, like, "It's heartbreaking." From Missouri, Enton took a job as a local anchor in Savannah, Georgia, where he met his boyfriend of 10 years, Hunter. There, Enton was a one-man band, driving himself to crime scenes, setting up shots, and anchoring them himself, like the Anchorman version of Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins. A few years later came one of the highlights of Enton's career. Carmel Caferio was retiring, and WSVN Miami wanted Enton to replace her. In Miami, he covered a little bit of everything. Hurricanes, car chases, alligators. When I asked what kinds of things could only happen in Florida, Enten answered without hesitation, "The guy who ate the face off." If you've heard the story, you likely remember it. High on bath salts, one man attacked another and ate his face. I couldn't remember what had happened to the victim. Did that guy die? I just remember it was under a bridge. "Isn't Florida also where the lady's pet chimpanzee," Enten nodded, "ate her face off?" In 2020, Enten, who is Miami-based, went national, joining familiar network news names like Chris Cuomo, Dan Abrams, and Banfield at News Nation, a startup channel. Like Enten and his hero, Caferio, the network has a flair for the dramatic. It started as an entertainment station, playing reruns of Blue Bloods and In the Heat of the Night. Its parent company, Nexstar, owns 75% of the CW. In the fall of 2021, News Nation launched a morning show, followed 6 months later by a primetime block. The goal is a 24-hour network like CNN or Fox News, for those who can no longer stand CNN or Fox News. I've been a devotee of CNN forever. It's just so one-sided, just nonstop Trump, 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 Trump. You just get tired of it. It's just exhausting, said one News Nation viewer, calling into Abrams' show. "I got to watch CNN, and my Republican husband got to watch Fox. We never would share. We can both watch News Nation." The gambit seems to be working. A representative from News Nation says they'll achieve the round-the-clock goal by late spring or early summer. In January, News Nation's ratings averaged 113,000 total viewers, its strongest month ever, up 217% from the previous year, ranking it number one in growth and 63rd among ad-supported cable networks. For one of his first News Nation stories, Enten covered a major cyber attack on a local school district. He teetered on a stool in the middle of a causeway so that his crew could capture a generic Miami skyline in the background. Since then, Enten has covered a range of grisly stories: missing children, murdered children, national disasters. During Hurricane Ian, after he and Powell rescued a dog from a sailboat, a neighbor said, "Oh, that's like the meanest dog ever. It tried to kill my dog." But Enten cradled it in his arms anyway. While reporting on Petito, he helped launch Missing in America, a program that has drawn attention to 75 missing persons cases and counting. According to News Nation producer Paige Lubdell, 20 families have received some type of closure. Usually, it's sad news, but three different cases have ended with a loved one found safely. Enten journeyed for work almost every week and spent 150 days a year in Marriott hotels, accruing enough points for a week with Hunter at the St. Regis in Aspen. But much like his hero Cooper, who once said, "I still, to this day, feel like if I take a vacation, someone smarter and younger will take my place," there's never a point in your career that you reach that you think, "I'm safe, I'm here." Enten struggled to relax. He covered the Surfside condominium collapse for weeks before taking a break with Hunter and a few friends to unwind for the weekend. "Be a normal human," Enten tried to remind himself. "Chill the F out." But while his friends sat around a fire, drinking and having fun, Enten ruminated on the building's demolition. Then, feeling like a buzzkill, he took out his phone to watch it happen. As it crumbled on live television, Enten's walls came down too. He started to cry, which was embarrassing, given the fire and the friends and the drinking. But that's what always happened. Whenever a story ended, Enten felt this weird release. For 4 days, Enten and I ate together, stood in the cold together, and sat squished together in the daddy wagon. And for that entire time, he remained genuinely upbeat and shockingly low maintenance, finding joy in simple pleasures like eating a ball of mystery mush that might have been mashed potatoes or something else, I love it, he said, still not knowing what it was. It has a little spice. He never complained, not even when a waiter served him a salad topped with walnuts, to which Enton is allergic. I'm just picking around them. When he saw the dark hallways and bumpy rock walls in my hotel, which reminded me of a medieval torture movie, he pointed out the bright side. It looked tornado-proof. Only one thing seemed to make him nervous. Me. On our first day together, he worried that I might be doing like a bad article. He met my gaze, wanting to make sure. I can trust you, right? In Moscow, Enton shared turf with journalists from all over the world and took it in stride when those from bigger outfits bossed him around. He rolled with it when a photographer from Fox News kept calling News Nation's crew the B-team, telling them where to park and where not to set up their stuff. In lieu of an apology, the photographer would later confess that he was struggling to pass a kidney stone. But Enton's crew were used to being treated like amateurs. Everywhere we go, we're outnumbered, he said. Fox News, in particular, seemed to be everywhere all at once. It was almost like they were in the trees or dropping out of planes. They were getting interviews nobody else could. Exclusives with the Moscow Police Department for what seemed to me like political reasons. At one point, a Fox News digital reporter crept up on Enton saying, I keep having to write up your stuff. I'm always aggregating it, which seems inappropriate, because I'm at Fox. We're doing a little bit too many stories, I think. Like others from her station, she seemed eager for Enton to know she lived in New York City. Enton nodded politely, okay, cool. She acknowledged her network's advantage over Enton, saying, there's just so many of us here. Before leaving, she gestured at the house. Everything's been picked dry. On December 7th, Enton went live on Twitter to discuss the Moscow Police Department's announcement that they were searching for a white Hyundai Elantra. Questions from Enton's followers peppered the screen as the live stream population ticked from 2,100 to 2,200 and upward. Enton read some of the queries out loud. Do I have to sleep out here? No. He tried to tamp down rumors, reminding his fans that the owners of the Elantra were not being called suspects. In response, people commented, OMG, I love how you say Hyundai, laughing crying face. Sounds like you're getting a cold. Someone get Brian hot cocoa, please. Enton thought the Elantra update constituted a perfect task for hungry sleuths, an opportunity to really help. Now that that car has been identified, it's almost like they've got their mission and here they go. Enton hoped they'd take off running and find the car. Instead, they remained fixated on his sniffly nose, trying to solve the mystery of whether Enton had allergies or a virus. Sorry, Enton said. He wasn't wearing mittens and the cold was unbearable. My hand is starting to hurt. He signed off Twitter and shoved his hands in his pockets. They get mad when I leave. Enton's gaze drifted to the overflowing dumpster across the street. It was the sort of thing he would have reported on when he was just starting out. City fails to deal with overflowing refuse. When I asked about how he'd shoot it, he clarified, if there wasn't a murder, you mean? Yeah. Enton waved for me to follow him over to it. He anchored the pretend live shot with serious enthusiasm. The trash is so high. Let me stand next to the trash. Let me show you. He positioned his body next to the dumpster for scale. If I stand here, it's literally above my head. I'm 5'8", and the trash is above my head. Dramatically, he concluded, and if it wasn't this cold, imagine what this would smell like. Even when the news is garbage, Enton is a star. On December 29th, a source alerted Enton that the Moscow PD would be holding an important press conference the next day. Enton felt like something big was about to erupt. The next morning at 8:02 a.m., he received a Twitter DM from someone in Pennsylvania law enforcement saying that a Brian Kohlberger was in custody in connection with the case. After some back and forth, he confirmed it. At 8:26 a.m., Enten tweeted, "An arrest has been made in the Moscow, Idaho quadruple homicide, I have learned." 16 minutes later, arrest happened early this morning in Pennsylvania. At 9:06 a.m., arrest paperwork filed in Monroe County, Pennsylvania, shows 28-year-old Brian Christopher Kohlberger is being held for extradition in a homicide investigation in Moscow, Idaho. On my way to Pennsylvania now. At 9:09 a.m., he tweeted Kohlberger's mugshot. By 11 a.m., he was on a plane. When Enten landed, the tip had made national news. Later, stationed outside the Kohlberger's gated community, Enten received another Twitter message from a woman claiming to be one of their neighbors. She offered to drive him through the gates. They met at a gas station, where Enten tucked aside his fear of being kidnapped because she seemed like a nice lady. Enten got in the car. She dropped him outside the Kohlberger house, which had been raided less than 24 hours before. Enten went live on Twitter. He knocked on the door, its pane busted out by police in the raid. Behind it came a muffled voice, demanding to know who Enten was. Enten introduced himself as a journalist. The voice told him to go away. He did. Over the next few days, Enten barely slept, fueled by an adrenaline rush as he chased down rumors and reported on the ones that were true. Later, he received a text message from Kaylee Gonsalves' family thanking him for his news coverage. Maybe it was exhaustion, but the text brought tears to Enten's eyes. "It just feels so good to know they think I've done a good job and been respectful. It's truly so effing incredible and has me feeling really raw." Since Kohlberger's arrest, so-called suspects like Jack Showalter, Jack Ducour, Gonsalves' ex-boyfriend, and Chapin's fraternity brothers have been exonerated by reality, though who knows what kind of psychological or professional toll this kind of experience exacts. One of the surviving roommates, Dylan Mortensen, however, continues to withstand a huge amount of abuse. Mortensen and the other surviving roommate, Bethany Funk, both named as victims in prosecutorial filings, were pilloried on social media, a friend of theirs told me, alleging that one self-appointed detective posted pictures of Mortensen and Funk every day, analyzing their evil expressions and accusing them of the crime. Neuroscientists have found that when we interact with social media, it's the anticipation of answers, not their existence, that stirs in us a need to keep clicking, scrolling, and posting. Perhaps that's why Kohlberger's arrest brings less closure to sleuths than one might anticipate. In our internet-addicted brains, it seems productive to skip past endings and repost whatever fresh allegations we've just read, misguided by the myth that social media is a tool for social justice. In reality, studies show that screens lower our empathy, increasing the tendency toward cruelty, which can camouflage online as heroism. Injustice on Demand, True Crime in the Digital Streaming Era, Dr. Tanya Horek writes, "The notion that audiences can participate in true crime has, of course, always been a feature of the genre, because it offers a metaphorical seat in the jury box. What is different about today's true crime audience," Horek says, "is their expectation that the genre be literally interactive, that justice is something that can be accessed through binge-watching. There is something deeply human about fascination with crime. The central enigma of murder is death, a painful reality that comes for us all, and one that we instinctively fight throughout our lives. Differentiating ourselves from victims like Mortensen and her housemates by judging their choices and hunting their killers as if that protects us from random acts of violence. But whatever we might learn at Brian Koberger's trial, there can never be a tolerable explanation for what happened to Maddie Mogan, Kaylee Gonsalves, Zanneke Nodal, and Ethan Chapin. We want to believe in social media's immense power to reverse, or at least rectify, injustices. The alternative is that we've bought into a massive conspiracy, surfing and shaming and buying, fooled by the idea that our addiction to screens is productive, virtuous. Never mind the destruction we leave in our wake. Kaziah Weir writes on books, Six Pack, Three Love Stories, A Western, and Two More to Enjoy. Lone Women, Victor Levi's deft genre bender, opens on Adelaide, a black farmer, setting her home ablaze with the bloodied bodies of her parents inside. She flees California for Montana with a padlocked steamer trunk and secrets to spare. Published by One World. Community Board, recently dumped Darcy returns home, where she loses and finds herself in a Nextdoor-esque website and Tara Conklin's droll investigation of what we owe our neighbors and ourselves, published by Mariner. Biography of X, and Catherine Lacey's newest, a widowed writer attempts to understand her late wife, an enigmatic artist, through a series of interviews, The resulting biography is prismatic and brilliant, published by Ferrero, Strauss, and Giroux, calling Ukraine. In this biting comedy, Johannes Lichtman offers a glimpse of Ukraine, pre-2020 Russian invasion, through the blinkered eyes of a young American working abroad, published by Mary Sue Rushi Books. The Great Reclamation. Is Singapore a fraught decades love, a fraught decades-long love story unfurls against the upheaval of Japan's invasion and the country's renewal in this precisely and elegantly rendered epic from Rachel Heng, published by Riverhead. Romantic comedy. Curtis Sittenfield presents a romantic formula flip. Woman comedy writer, pop star man, and investigates gender expectations and dynamics. Amid the Humor, published by Random House. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.